AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. You know, if you think back maybe to the last century, whenever conversations about global power or strategic conflict came up, it almost always seemed to circle back to one thing: oil.
Right. Energy.
Yeah.
Pipelines, crude prices. That really did define the map.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at the sources we've pulled together for you today, that entire narrative, it seems to have just fundamentally shifted. It's kind of surprising, actually.
It really is.
The major conflicts, the big constraints of this century, they're not about fossil fuels anymore. They're about these microscopic semiconductors, these tiny little chips.
Yeah, that's a huge pivot. And the sources really hammer this home right away. The whole world is basically reorienting itself around these things. They're the engines driving modern industry. They power, you know, our most advanced defense systems. And critically, they are the absolute bedrock for the next waves of AI.
So this whole area, that's what we're calling semiconductor geopolitics.
That's the term, yeah. It's where technology, national resilience, and global power all intersect.
Okay, so let's unpack that a bit and maybe define our mission here today. We're not just talking about commodities anymore, are we? Like things bought and sold easily on the market?
No, not at all. This is foundational infrastructure. The sources even call it the nervous system of global digital civilization. Which is quite a phrase.
Wow. Okay. So our mission today for this deep dive is to really get into the sources, understand the strategic constraints that are emerging, get a handle on the key players, the U.S., China, and, well, crucially, Taiwan, and really analyze the massive, almost systemic risks that seem baked into this global dependency we have.
And for you, the listener, the stakes here are... well, they're pretty much existential. This is about national resilience, fundamentally.
I saw.
Well, control over the ability to design these chips, to fabricate them, to distribute them, that now translates directly into global influence. Strategic leverage. If a country or even a major company can't get reliable access to the cutting edge nodes, you know, the 3-nanometer, the 5-nanometer chips we keep hearing about, they risk being strategically sidelined, basically irrelevant on the world stage.
So access means you get to lead. Lack of access, you're vulnerable.
Profoundly vulnerable. Yeah,
cool.
Access gives you room to maneuver, to innovate. Lack of it is a serious constraint.
And it's not just about having any chip, is it? It's about having the best chip, the most advanced one.
Yeah.
Because that's what gives you the edge, especially in AI.
Precisely. The most advanced fabrication tech. That allows for these almost exponential gains. Density, speed, power efficiency. Oh, it all scales up.
Right.
And whoever controls that technology gets a massive head start in the AI race. It's undeniable.
Can you maybe quantify that difference a bit, like between a 7-nanometer and a 3-nanometer chip?
Sure. So to put it simply, the difference isn't just marginal. It's huge. When you move from one generation like 7-nanometer down to 3-nanometers, you can often pack maybe twice the number of transistors onto the same tiny piece of silicon.
Twice the density.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And that translates directly into much lower power consumption and significantly faster processing speeds, which if you're trying to run these enormous foundational AI models everyone's talking about, well, it's non-negotiable. You need that efficiency and speed.
So that technological gap, that edge,
that's
where the strategic power really lies.
That's exactly where it's concentrated.
Okay. So if chips are, let's say, the new oil, how does this new power dynamic actually play out in international relations? The sources we have point to this big shift, this great reorientation. And it seems largely driven by policy changes, particularly out of Washington, treating semiconductors not just as commercial goods anymore, but as, well, strategic assets, maybe even dual use, military assets.
That's the heart of it. This reorientation is defined by access, like we said. Nations that secure access to the cutting edge nodes, the AI accelerators, they get to lead. Those who don't, they face immediate and probably worsening strategic constraints.
And the U.S. has decided denying access is the key lever.
It seems so. Denying competitors access to these specific tools is being seen as maybe the most effective form of strategic leverage they have right now.
Which brings us straight to the main policy tool we've seen used again and again, export controls. This is where policy really becomes a weapon, right?
Absolutely. It's an instrument of strategic power, plain and simple.
So when did this really kick off? What did those first actions look like?
The big, undeniable shift happened in October 2022. That's when the U.S. rolled out its first major new wave of export controls. And they were very specific, very targeted.
Targeted how?
Aimed squarely at advanced chips, the kind used for AI, and also the incredibly complex manufacturing tools needed to make them, if they were destined for China.
Right, so it wasn't about restricting chips for, I don't know, coffee makers or something.
Exactly, not consumer goods. These initial controls focused on things like the high-end NVIDIA GPUs, the H100s, the A100s, the workhorses for training large language models and doing serious deep learning.
So it was a direct shot at slowing down China's progress in AI. And presumably its military applications too.
That was clearly the stated goal, yes. Blunting technological advancement in AI, which has obvious military implications.
And it didn't stop there, did it?
Yeah.
The sources show this tightening just kept going.
Relentlessly. Throughout 2023 into 2024, the restrictions just kept expanding significantly. The net got much wider.
What did that involve?
Well, they added more types of chips to the list, restricted more categories of equipment, especially things related to advanced lithography and etching, which are crucial steps.
Okay.
And they expanded the list of Chinese companies and institutions that needed special, hard-to-get licenses. It felt like a very deliberate, sustained effort to plug every possible gap.
I think a key detail here that really shows how fundamental this is the equipment side. You mentioned lithography.
Mm-hmm.
The sources point out that even though the U.S. doesn't make many of the final chips itself, it dominates critical areas like the design software EDA tools and a lot of the inspection and measurement tools you need in the fabs. But the biggest equipment constraint isn't even American, is it?
No, that's right. We have to talk about EUV, extreme ultraviolet lithography.
Right.
This is probably the single most critical choke point in the whole supply chain. If you want to make any chip that's 7 nanometers or smaller, so the really advanced stuff, you need these EUV machines.
And they only come from one place?
Pretty much. One company.
Yeah.
ASML, based in the Netherlands. But here's the catch. Those machines rely heavily on U.S. components and U.S. intellectual property.
Ah, okay. So that gives Washington leverage.
Exactly. Washington has been able to use its influence through export control regulations to effectively block the shipment of the most advanced EUV machines and even some of the slightly older DUV deep ultraviolet tools to China.
That's a fundamental block. If you can't buy the machine.
You can't make the advanced chip. Doesn't matter how much money you throw at it. It's a hard physical constraint.
And the pressure kept increasing. The sources mentioned that by December 2024, there were even more controls, targeting things like memory systems.
Yes, further strengthening, targeting memory, other semiconductor tools. And the rationale was explicitly stated again, constraining China's military and AI capabilities. This timeline doesn't look reactive. It looks proactive, like strategic warfare being waged through technological gatekeeping.
And the U.S. wasn't just acting within its own borders. There was this point about Taiwan.
Yes. That's crucial. It shows the depth of the U.S. reach here. The sources mention a specific directive coming from the U.S. government telling Taiwan's giant, TSMC.
The most important chipmaker in the world.
The most important one. Telling them to suspend certain shipments of their most advanced chips, 7 nanometer or smaller, specifically to certain Chinese customers, especially those involved in AI or GPU development.
Wow, that's applying immense pressure directly through the supply chain, dictating the business of a huge foreign company.
It demonstrates incredible leverage, yeah. Directly onto the single most critical supplier on the planet.
So how has Beijing responded to all this, this strategic chokehold, essentially?
Well, China's response points towards a deep, probably irreversible commitment to what they call tech sovereignty or self-sufficiency.
Moving away from dependence.
Exactly, from dependence to resilience. So instead of just trying to buy what they need, Beijing has been actively discouraging its own companies from buying high-end NVIDIA hardware, for instance.
Mm.
And at the same time, they're pouring absolutely astronomical sums of money into homegrown alternatives. The most visible example is probably Huawei's Ascend AI chips and the systems they're building around them.
Okay, so we've kind of mapped out the battleground, the weapons being used, export controls mostly. What does this contest ultimately mean for, well, for the global order?
It means this struggle is going to define who leads in AI development, who controls these critical dual-use technologies, and ultimately where the center of gravity for future innovation is going to be. The whole architecture of global leadership in this era really demands clarity on who controls these strategic assets. If you can control the gates of tech progress, well, you control the pace of economic growth and military modernization worldwide.
Okay, if the whole game is about controlling access to the best chips, then we absolutely have to talk about the physical place where most of them are actually made, Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
For decades, this island has, well, also quietly, almost invisibly, carried this unbelievably disproportionate share of the world's digital infrastructure. It's just a staggering concentration of capability.
And that concentration really centers on one company, TSMC, the
right.
Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. Their dominance isn't just, you know, a business success story. It's become a fundamental geopolitical fact.
Yeah.
The security of Taiwan's chip industry is arguably the single most sensitive strategic issue right now, just because of the sheer complexity and the power that TSMC holds.
This is where those numbers from the sources are just mind-blowing. We need to make the scale really tangible for people.
Okay, well, TSMC isn't just a leader. At the absolute cutting edge, they are basically unrivaled. Think about the most advanced nodes, the ones needed for the latest iPhones, the biggest AI data centers, the newest military tech.
Right.
TSMC holds more than 90% market share at the most advanced 3-nanometer node.
90%.
90. And even if you look at the slightly older but still incredibly advanced 5-nanometer standard, they still have an estimated 70 to 80% share globally.
90% at the most critical node.
Yeah.
That isn't just market dominance. That's that's effectively a global monopoly on the chips that power the future.
Pretty much. And look at their client list. It's the absolute A-list of global tech. Apple, NVIDIA, AMD, Qualcomm, every single one of them is utterly dependent on a steady flow of chips coming out of fabs on that one island.
Wow.
This incredible concentration has basically turned TSMC's facilities, the big ones, in places like Hsinchu and Tainan, into strategic assets in their own right.
And this is where that idea of the Silicon Shield comes in.
Exactly. The concept is that Taiwan is so indispensable to global tech supply chains that any military action against it would instantly cause a global economic meltdown.
So the idea is that this deters conflict because the consequences would be too catastrophic for everyone, including the aggressor.
That's the theory, yes. A form of deterrence based on economic indispensability.
It sounds like a clever strategy, maybe. But the sources seem to suggest this position is both a strength and a huge liability.
Oh, absolutely. The shield might deter, but it also paints this giant, irreplaceable target right on the island.
It's the ultimate single point of failure.
That's the core vulnerability, writ large. This global dependence on one island, really one company on one island, for the world's most advanced chips, mm-hmm. It creates systemic risk on a scale that most economists, frankly, can barely model. We're talking about TSMC's geopolitical risk being absolutely central to global stability.
So any disruption there,
yeah,
it just fractures everything.
Instantly. The whole global chip supply chain just breaks.
And the sources outline a few ways this disruption could happen, right?
Yeah.
Not just the obvious one.
Yeah. There are three main scenarios they highlight, all terrifying. First, obviously, is the geopolitical nightmare. Actual military conflict across the Taiwan Strait.
Yeah, the worst case.
The second is serious, but maybe less dramatic day to day. Coercive pressure from Beijing.
What does that look like?
Could be anything from economic blockades, cyber attacks targeting TSMC's infrastructure, maybe regulatory pressure aimed at forcing policy changes in Taipei that Beijing wants. Coercion is kind of the silent weapon here.
And the third way is just nature.
Yeah. The terrifying simplicity of a natural disaster. Taiwan sits right on major seismic fault lines. So a major earthquake or even a massive typhoon hitting those incredibly sensitive fabrication plants, the fabs.
Are the fabs built to withstand that?
They're designed to be resilient, certainly. Very robust, but a truly catastrophic event, something causing major structural failure,
yeah.
That could take facilities offline for months, maybe even years, to repair and restart production. The precision required is just immense.
And the consequences, if TSMC did go offline,
yeah.
Even temporarily, the sources paint a pretty grim picture.
Immediate and severe, across every sector. If TSMC stopped shipping tomorrow, the sources suggest automakers would halt production lines within weeks. We saw a little taste of that during the early pandemic shortages, but this would be orders of magnitude worse.
Okay.
Cloud companies would lose access to the AI accelerators they desperately need to keep training and running large models. Even critical national security systems, which rely on the most advanced, often custom-designed, hardened chips. they'd face immediate setbacks. Modernization efforts would just grind to a halt.
So this reliance isn't just an economic worry, it's like a strategic handcuff.
Absolutely.
Which really underlines why diversification isn't just some nice-to-have policy goal.
Mm.
It sounds like an absolute imperative for global stability, both economic and military.
It really is. The clear need is to build genuine redundancy. Alternative cutting-edge fabrication capacity across multiple different regions. Japan is moving. The U.S. is trying. Europe needs to step up to dilute that intense concentration. Because that dependence on one island, one company, it's arguably the single biggest unmitigated risk to global peace and economic security we face today. Hashtag tag IV. China's drive for tech sovereignty.
Okay, so if the U.S. strategy is largely about restriction, and Taiwan's position is defined by this critical yet precarious dominance, then China's strategy seems simpler in concept, but maybe monumentally expensive in practice.
Yeah.
To achieve sovereignty.
That's right. They seem to view this whole semiconductor challenge as fundamental to their national destiny. And they are pouring absolutely enormous resources into catching up and eventually becoming self-sufficient enough to withstand those U.S. constraints.
We're talking serious money here.
Oh, yeah. Since about 2015, the sources indicate Beijing has funneled more than $150 billion into its domestic ship sector. And that's through state funds, massive subsidies, centrally coordinated research programs.
Wow.
The goal seems pretty straightforward. Rapidly build up their own domestic fabrication and design capabilities. Reduce that external dependence, ideally to zero, especially for the strategically sensitive stuff like AI and defense.
But the sources also suggest they aren't necessarily trying to beat TSMC at making the absolute tiniest, most cutting-edge chip right this second. There's something else going on.
Yeah, that's a fascinating insight. It seems China is trying to close the performance gap using a really clever systems approach, basically using integration and software to get the absolute maximum power out of the chips they can currently produce domestically.
Okay, explain that. How does a systems approach work here?
So the core idea is focusing on the performance of the entire system, not just relying on the raw specs of one individual chip. Huawei, for example, which has been right in the crosshairs of U.S. restrictions.
Right.
They've developed their Ascend AI processor line, but crucially, they've also built these orchestration systems like Cloud Matrix.
Cloud Matrix.
Yeah. What it does effectively is take thousands of these domestic Ascend processors and link them together seamlessly. It creates these unified, highly efficient compute clusters.
Can you help break down the difference between that and, say, the NVIDIA approach? What does scaling and orchestration mean strategically?
Okay, think of it maybe like this. NVIDIA's top chip, the H100, it's like a Formula One car.
Right.
It's built on the most advanced 3-nanometer or 5-millimeter tech from TSMC, optimized for raw singular power and speed. One H100 chip delivers incredible performance on its own.
Got it.
The Ascend chip may be built on slightly older 7-millimeter or even 14-millimeter domestic tech, might be more like, I don't know, a high-performance sedan. It's slower individually than the F1 car.
Okay, so slower chip. But the Chinese strategy is put 1,000 sedans on the road working together perfectly.
Exactly. That's the scaling and orchestration part. The source gives a really concrete example. A powerful large language model called DeepSeek R1 Safe. It was trained entirely on a cluster of 1,000 Ascend chips.
1,000 of them working together.
Right. So while one Ascend chip definitely doesn't match the raw power of an H100, the clever scaling and the highly efficient architecture Huawei used demonstrates how they're strategically narrowing the gap in total compute capacity needed for training these huge AI models.
So they're sacrificing maybe peak single chip performance for overall system scale and efficiency.
Precisely. And that's a major advance. It shows genuine innovation at the system level, even while their actual chip manufacturing tech is still playing catch up to TSMC's absolute cutting edge.
And this kind of progress, this system design capability, it feeds back into the policy decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. It brings us back to China's decision to limit buying high-end NVIDIA chips. It's not just, you know, sour grapes because they're restricted. It signals a calculated strategic shift away from relying on foreign tech they might lose access to and towards confidence in their own domestic resilience.
So they're almost reframing the U.S. restrictions as a catalyst, pushing them faster towards their own solutions, like these Huawei clusters.
It definitely accelerates their vision of technological independence, yeah. It signals growing confidence that they can use domestic alternatives, even if there's maybe a short-term performance trade-off.
Yeah.
And that aligns perfectly with their broader goal of tech sovereignty.
Ensuring their AI infrastructure, their supercomputing, their defense systems,
mm-hmm.
all can advance without depending on, well, the political decisions of foreign suppliers.
That shift from restriction driving resilience is a really key takeaway from the sources.
Still, we need to keep the scale of this challenge in perspective. $150 billion is a lot, but the source mentions an external estimate, I think from RAND's Jimmy Goodrich.
Ah, yes. He noted that China would probably need at least another $1 trillion.
A trillion, on top of the $150 billion.
Yes. An additional $1 trillion, potentially, to achieve true end-to-end self-sufficiency across the entire semiconductor supply chain, materials, tools, design, fabs, everything.
Wow. That number just underscores the unbelievable difficulty of this task.
Yeah.
Replicating this incredibly mature, globally distributed, hyper-complex ecosystem.
It's maybe the biggest industrial challenge any nation has ever attempted. Truly monumental. But the implication for everyone else is still critical. As China pushes harder for self-reliance, the global balance of innovation is going to shift.
And as the source notes, if they achieve that sustained resilience, eventually that turns into real, unconstrained global influence.
That's the long game. Hashtag tag V. The U.S. struggle to rebuild leadership.
Okay, let's shift focus now to the United States. For the U.S., semiconductors aren't just a strategic issue. They feel like a critical test of whether America can actually sustain its global tech leadership.
Mm-hmm.
The big political response we saw was the CHIPS Act.
Right, the CHIPS and Science Act. Signed into law back in 2022, and it represented a really enormous commitment of capital.
How much are we talking about?
Well, the total authorization was around $280 billion for various science and tech initiatives over 10 years. But crucially, $52.7 billion of that was specifically earmarked for semiconductors, manufacturing, R&D, and workforce development.
$52 billion, that's a huge number. But the goal wasn't just corporate welfare, right? It was targeted.
Oh, absolutely. It was a very targeted effort trying to correct what many saw as decades of outsourcing manufacturing and kind of strategic drift in this area.
So what were the specific goals?
Pretty clear and ambitious. First, incentivize domestic fabrication. Get major chip makers, both American companies like Intel and foreign ones like TSMC and Samsung, to build new advanced factories, fabs on U.S. soil.
Okay, bring manufacturing back.
Second, boost funding for critical R&D to make sure the U.S. leads in designing the next generation of chips. And third, a really crucial piece, train the skilled workforce needed to actually staff these incredibly complex 247 operations.
So the overall vision was reshoring manufacturing, reducing that heavy reliance on overseas production, especially Taiwan.
That was the core idea, yes. Fundamental reduction of dependency.
But the sources suggest actually doing this, executing this vision, has been, well, harder than just passing a bill.
Yes, far from smooth. And the kind of flagship project for this whole reshoring effort, the huge TSMC plant being built in Arizona, has unfortunately become this perfect, maybe painful case study in just how difficult it is to replicate this whole intricate ecosystem.
What happened in Arizona?
Well, the project hit major roadblocks almost immediately. TSMC had to push back the start of production, initially planned for 2023, out to 2025.
Why the delay?
The main initial reason cited was a severe shortage of specialized, skilled workers, not just PhDs, but calibrate the incredibly complex equipment.
Mm.
It got so bad that TSMC actually had to fly in hundreds of their own experienced technicians and managers directly from Taiwan just to troubleshoot the equipment installation and try to get the project back on track.
That anecdote is so revealing, isn't it? It tells you the challenge isn't just about throwing money or buying machines.
Exactly. It's about the institutional know-how. It's about the maturity of the local supply chain for specialized chemicals and parts. And it's absolutely about the human expertise that's been built up over decades, primarily in Asia.
It's the whole ecosystem.
It's the lesson from Arizona, really.
Yeah.
You can spend $50 billion, you can ship in the absolute latest EUV machines, but you cannot just buy a mature, functioning semiconductor ecosystem off the shelf.
It takes time.
Mm.
And culture, maybe.
It takes time, specialized suppliers for everything from ultra-pure gases to specific little tools, and a workforce that just gets how these ultra-clean, high-precision environments operate. Those things have to be built, nurtured.
So while the Arizona facility did finally hit a milestone, the sources say it started producing 4-nanometer chips around January 2025. The bigger lesson about the difficulty remains.
It does. The delay, the struggles, they underscore the enduring cost of the dependency the U.S. is trying to escape.
Right, because despite the CHIPS Act, the U.S. still relies heavily on Taiwan for its most advanced chips today.
Yes, and that reliance has huge policy implications. It limits America's strategic freedom of action. Any major disruption in Taiwan, conflict, blockade, natural disaster would hammer every part of the U.S. economy. Consumer electronics, cloud computing, defense, everything takes a hit. It forces policymakers into really tough, constrained choices.
So it basically ties U.S. foreign policy even more tightly to Taiwan's fate, making the island's security almost inseparable from America's own tech and economic health.
That's the strategic reality, yes. The U.S. finds itself having to fund the Chi-Chi-Pei Act to build domestic capacity while also working intensely to maintain stability and deter conflict in the Taiwan Strait. It's doing both simultaneously.
So if the U.S. genuinely wants to maintain its global tech leadership and secure its supply chains, what's needed now beyond just that initial GPDES Act funding?
Well, the sources argue for a truly coherent, sustained U.S. semiconductor strategy, not just a one-off cash injection.
Coherent how? What does that involve?
It means effectively linking the ongoing GPS funding with really robust long-term workforce development programs, which are notoriously tricky to sustain politically, getting the community colleges and universities aligned.
Sure.
It also means sophisticated supply chain resilience planning, mapping dependencies, identifying choke points, and critically, deepening alliances with other key players like Japan, South Korea, the Netherlands, Germany.
So without that comprehensive approach, treating the money, the workforce, the regulations, the diplomacy, all as one connected strategy.
The momentum from the Chi-Chi-Pei Act could just fizzle out. And the strategic goal behind the export controls restricting China while boosting domestic capability could erode if the U.S. can't actually build up that alternative capacity fast enough.
It sounds like a race against time and against immense complexity.
It is, and the geopolitical clock is definitely ticking.
You know, the story we've mostly traced so far is one of really intense, almost zero-sum competition, right? The U.S. tries to restrict China. China hits back with huge investments in self-sufficiency. Taiwan sits in the middle holding this incredibly valuable, incredibly fragile key.
That's been the dominant narrative.
But some of the sources we looked at offer a slightly different perspective, one that tries to look beyond just this rivalry. They suggest that strategies built purely on trying to achieve technological domination might actually, in the long run, just deepen global instability.
Yeah, this is where the conversation shifts towards a concept the sources call systemic integrity. The argument is essentially that the path forward shouldn't just be about competitive control. It needs to be grounded in something more like resilience, clarity, and a shared sense of systemic health, moving towards cooperative security.
Okay, systemic integrity. That sounds aspirational. What does it mean in practice?
Well, it starts with a different way of thinking, a call for what one source described as awakened leadership in geopolitics.
Awakened leadership.
Meaning, instead of just seeing semiconductors as commercial goods or military tools, recognizing them for what they are, the actual nervous system of global civilization.
The nervous system.
Yeah, if you do them that way, if that nervous system fails, then everything fails. Economies, communication, security.
So thinking like that requires a shift in the conversation.
A profound shift, yeah. What the sources call awakened diplomacy and technology. Moving the core question away from who gets to dominate the supply chain towards something more like, how do we collectively construct an ecosystem that actually strengthens peace while still allowing innovation to flourish for everyone?
Shifting from zero-sum competition to shared stability and maybe mutual economic security.
That's the idea. Less about winning, more about ensuring the system itself survives and thrives.
Okay, but how does that theoretical framework translate into, you know, actual actions? What does a resilient, systemically sound ecosystem look like physically?
Well, the first, most obvious step is active, strategic diversification of production. Building significant cutting-edge fab capacity across multiple geopolitically stable regions.
So not just relying on Taiwan and South Korea.
Exactly. Fabs need to operate at scale not just there, but also in the U.S., definitely in Japan, where TSMC is already making moves, and in established European hubs, too, perhaps Germany or elsewhere. The goal is ensuring no single political crisis, no economic shock, no natural disaster in one location can break the entire global supply.
So it's not enough for the U.S. just to build fabs in Arizona. Japan needs to succeed. Europe needs to step up, too. It requires a coordinated effort.
Very much so. And it means alliances need to evolve beyond just talking shops. They need to become real cooperative frameworks.
What does that look like?
It means things like sharing capacity commitments. Maybe allied nations agree to produce certain percentages of critical chips domestically. It means pooling resources for R&D into next-gen materials or manufacturing techniques, and establishing shared governance protocols, ways to ensure transparency in supply chains and coordinate allocation if or when a crisis hits.
Okay, that sounds like a much deeper level of cooperation than we typically see.
Yeah.
And the sources also draw this really interesting line connecting semiconductor policy directly to the future of AI governance.
Yes, that's a powerful connection they make. The argument is essentially that how these foundational chips are designed, manufactured, and distributed will directly shape how intelligence itself, AI, is governed.
How so?
Well, if the control over chips becomes highly centralized, highly weaponized, used primarily for competitive advantage, then it stands to reason that AI development and deployment will follow that same path. Centralized, potentially weaponized, driven by national rivalry rather than shared benefit or safety.
I see. So semiconductor policy isn't just about hardware. It's implicitly setting the stage for AI governance.
Exactly. It connects chip policy directly to this broader idea of awakened AI governance, governance that prioritizes foresight, ethical considerations, global stability, and societal security over purely short-term profit or strategic advantage.
That's a really profound perspective. It demands that leaders, both political and technological, act with a much greater sense of responsibility, looking beyond just winning the current competition to ensuring the whole system remains stable and beneficial for humanity in the long run.
It forces us to think about the long-term health of the entire technological ecosystem, not just the short-term score in a geopolitical rivalry. So we've really covered a lot of ground today navigating this new global fault line. And the core tension seems incredibly clear now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. You've got Taiwan's unbelievable, almost fragile dominance in making the most advanced chips.
Mm-hmm. Then you have China's massive state-fueled drive for self-sufficiency, trying to break free from constraints.
And then America's complicated, expensive, and frankly slow struggle to rebuild its own manufacturing capacity after letting it drift away for decades.
Those three dynamics, Taiwan's dominance, China's push, America's rebuild, that seems to be the absolute core of 21st century global power dynamics right now.
And the stakes, as we kept saying, are just immense. They go way beyond just economics or corporate bottom lines.
Absolutely. This cuts right into national security. It determines who leads in innovation. Mm-hmm. And critically, it shapes the governance frameworks that we're going to need for managing artificial intelligence as it becomes more powerful.
It's infrastructure, global stability, future prosperity, all wrapped up in these tiny chips.
And that most unavoidable stake, the one that hangs over everything, is still that concentration in Taiwan. One major disruption there, conflict, coercion, even just a bad earthquake.
And the ripple effects are immediate and global. Economies shudder. AI progress stalls worldwide.
The technical stakes have become these huge, immediate strategic questions. Questions of societal management, conflict prevention. It's heavy stuff.
And the sources really argue, don't they, that this whole struggle over semiconductors points to a much larger choice facing us.
They do, that the future isn't just going to be shaped by the chips we manage to produce, but more fundamentally by the kind of leadership, the kind of strategic vision we embody as we navigate this.
Right. So considering the colossal resources being poured into this, the TFTS Act money in the U.S., China's $150 billion plus potentially $1 trillion more, all this political capital being spent, It leads to a final pretty critical question. One for you, the listener, to really chew on. What kind of concrete framework, something that goes beyond just the current cycle of rivalry and restriction, what framework would you create to try and ensure that this foundational technology, the bedrock of AI, is actually governed and managed for shared human values rather than just for national competitive advantage?
That's the challenge, isn't it? Moving beyond the zero-sum game. A tough question, but one we absolutely need to be asking.